Well, if you vote in Michigan's 8th Congressional District, which includes Lansing and East Lansing, of course, you'll be getting to know someone today. You'll be getting to know the Democrat tapped to run for Congress from the 8th. It's likely someone you do not know. Susanna Schrakeli of Clarkston is a Macomb County Assistant Prosecutor. She will be introduced today to the public. She is 29 years of age, a first-time candidate who prosecuted cases of physical and sexual abuse against kids for the past 6 years in Macomb County. She described herself as not a career politician yesterday to Chad Livengood of the Detroit News, who I'm leaning on for some of this information. Of course, as I'm sure you know by now, actress Melissa Gilbert dropped out of the race after the filing deadline, and another Democratic candidate was disqualified for insufficient signatures, which means that Melissa Gilbert's name will still appear on the primary ballot on August 2nd. But according to Chad Livengood, after the primary, Democrats plan to invoke a vague and rarely used state law allowing candidates to get Gilbert's name removed from the general election ballot for health reasons. But the new name there, Susanna Schrakeli of Clarkston, Michigan, likely the Democratic candidate for the 8th this November. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State. We're glad you've joined us today. The Detroit public schools have faced much controversy and uncertainty lately. It's faced the threat of insolvency, mass teacher sick outs, deplorable school conditions, and failing grades. It's fallen to our first guest today to lead the district. Interim Superintendent Alicia Merriweather was named to that position in March. She is the district's former director of curriculum and a DPS and University of Michigan graduate. Alicia Merriweather, welcome to Current State.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Very nice to have you and to talk with you here. We referred to you several times as the person at the eye of the hurricane here, so it's going to be interesting to get to know you here. There has been ongoing tension between the district and the state over the way ahead for the Detroit Public Schools. Just last week, the current DPS board announced its opposition to three key components of the state's plan to relaunch the district, the proposal for a couple $100 million in stability bonds. It complained about what it called the de facto confiscation of the assets of the Detroit Public School District without judicial process. There's a lot of fundamental disagreement here on the table. Where does all of that disagreement leave you?
Well, that was quite an intro there in terms of laying out the challenges that we're facing in Detroit Public Schools. And certainly your lead-in outlined some of the challenges we saw during the school year, and then obviously leading up to the legislation being passed, and then the opposition and tension around where we currently sit. I think really what we need to talk about, and the question that needs to be answered, is really should be focused on where does this leave the students of Detroit Public Schools Community District. And our main focus right now is moving forward and making sure that September 6th opens a new day for Detroit Public Schools Community District, and we are intent on making sure that this school year is much, much better than last year, and that we're looking up and down and across the district to make sure that we're intentionally examining the areas that need improvement and outlining a plan to make improvements, and that's not just for our staff, but also, of course, for our students and our families as we move forward.
Well, do you think the board's demands here, though, from last week, do you think those reflect the views of the residents of Detroit and the parents of DPS school kids?
I think that's a great question. I think it's pretty difficult to determine what percentage of the population those concerns represent. They certainly represent the concerns of the board. And seeing as we still do live in a democratic state, I think it is every person's right to express their opinions and to stand up for what they believe in. Most certainly, the board is representing what they believe to be correct. And I think as we expand and get further feedback from additional constituents, we would also have a better understanding of parents, communities, staff members' opinions about the legislation and about these claims relative to the assets of Detroit Public Schools Community District.
Well, given that a new school board will be elected in November, it begs the question, what kind of school board will the newly configured DPS need? I mean, would the district benefit from a board that works a little bit better with the state, or does the state need to be more flexible here?
I think when we're looking at the Board of Education as we move forward, the things that really need to be most important are around putting kids first, making sure that people have a good understanding of educational policy, and of course finances. I think the members of the new board also need to be forward-thinking and visionary. And I think when you're asking people of the city of Detroit, and of course I'm a resident of the city of Detroit, so I'll speak right now as a citizen as well. I think what people want to see is a board of education that stands up for the students and that is very sincere about moving the district forward. And I think in terms of how people work together, both internally, so the board being able to work well with themselves and making sure that there's collaboration within the board, and then external collaboration. But not to the fault of laying down and not speaking up on behalf of students or our community.
Let me ask you this, though. Would you say the current board, you said forward-thinking and visionary is the kind of board you need. Is the current board forward-thinking and visionary?
I think, you know, the current board they were elected by the citizens of the city of Detroit, and I think they have done what they needed to do in terms of standing up for the citizens and standing up for the students. I think when you talk to any of the board members, and I've been fortunate enough to be able to talk to several of the board members, you get the sense that they very much care about the students of the city of Detroit, and they very much care about the city. And so I certainly do not think that anyone should be casting stones at someone who's standing for students and for the city of Detroit.
Our guest is Detroit's interim superintendent of schools, Alicia Merriweather, here on WKAR's Current State. Do you expect current members of the board to run in November and stay on the board?
You know what? I'm not exactly sure. I know that some board members have stated that they are intentional about running, and I've heard from other members that they are not interested in running. So we'll just have to wait and see. The deadline to file for Board of Education for the City of Detroit, I believe, is July 22nd. So I certainly encourage anyone listening who is interested in running, and that includes, of course, the current board members, please don't miss the deadline. The deadline is July 22nd for the fall election. So sometimes people think, oh, the election is in the fall. It's very far away. Well, you have to file by July 22nd.
The DPS has been in the news so very much recently. Do you detect a lot of interest from Detroiters in serving on the next Detroit DPS school board, or are you concerned about a lack of qualified candidates?
Well, I think as I've talked in different settings and I've been in different meetings, I have heard from people who have expressed interest in running for the board. I was at a session last week with the National Association of Black Journalists, the Detroit chapter, and during that session there were a couple of the members there who said, you know, I've been thinking about this and I need to explore this a little further. I really right now don't have any insight into who is actually going to run. What I would say to people listening is if you feel like you would like to make a difference in Detroit Public Schools and you sincerely care about the students and teaching and learning in Detroit, seriously consider running for the school board.
I'd like to ask you about particular parts of the state plan here. The legislation did not create a so-called education commission mm-hmm. to control the number of charter schools in the district. There was a lot of disagreement about the importance of an education commission to do that very thing. the fact that it doesn't call for such a body, what does that mean for you? What does that mean for the district moving forward?
Well, I think as the conversation kind of swirled around the Detroit Education Commission, there were certainly people who had a strong opinion that it should move forward, and then there were other people who felt that it shouldn't. I think what we can all agree on, at least what I hope we can all agree on, is that there needs to be some sort of standard around excellence in schools, in teaching and learning in the city of Detroit. And so if that is, as we know now, that the DEC was not included in the legislation, there is a piece in the legislation that refers to an advisory.
Yes.
And so there is an advisory panel or board, but that advisory does not have any teeth, is basically what people have referenced. I think whether the advisory has teeth or not is kind of a side issue. I think what we need to bring back to the forefront is this discussion around high-quality teaching and learning environments for all students in the city of Detroit. And so I am an advocate for really pursuing this concept around accountability. And I mean, what I've said from the beginning of this discussion is if we're moving to an A to F grading system, my caveat with that is that people who are in education, people who are actually teachers and administrators and have a background in teaching and learning, should definitely be able to contribute to that A to F grading rubric, and that that rubric should not be developed by people who are non-educators. And so I still stand by that position, and I think with or without a DEC, there should be a standard for excellence in teaching and learning in the city of Detroit.
You were a teacher. How did you feel about this spring's teacher sick-outs?
Well, I think that the sick-outs, what you saw there, and I've spoken on this many times, that people felt very frustrated, and they felt at that point that the only way to have their voice heard was to express themselves in that way. And so I think, you know, I really wish that those issues could have been resolved in a different manner. But I think what people need to take away from the end result was that there were teachers who were extremely frustrated, and they were waiting for a larger audience to respond. And ultimately, through the sick-outs and through the various media events around our facilities issues and some other things that have been fairly negative, I think what's happened is people got a better picture of what's happening in Detroit public schools and how my hope is that what came about is that people got a better understanding of how they can help. And so I think at this point we're at a crossroads of really moving forward and saying from this point forward we need to have a more inclusive conversation. We need to be very alert. And one of the things that I've said pretty consistently is it's a very dangerous thing not to listen to people, and it's an even more dangerous thing to listen and not act. And so when you have situations where people really want to be listened to, they need to be heard. The first thing that we need to do is listen, and then the second thing we need to do is to figure out what we can do about what's been said. And so what I took away from this year really was the idea that Detroit Public Schools Community District needs to be more inclusive and transparent in our communication and in our planning. And so when I saw that we were coming up on the basically sunset of our academic plan, I decided to approach the new academic planning process in a different way. And so I did an all call to the district and asked anyone in the district who would like to help plan the academic, the academic plan moving forward, if they'd like to help to respond. And at this point, I have 167 employees, that's teachers, principals, central office, clericals, across all departments who have stepped up to help with our academic advisory council. And we had 15 committees working for about 6 weeks, and those results were announced last Wednesday. Each committee made a presentation of their recommendations for the district, and this is the first time that that type of inclusive planning has taken place, in at least in my memory, And basically what came of that is a series of recommendations that were based on research. So each committee was charged with finding at least 10 articles of research that were less than 10 years old, as well as at least 3 best practices cities or districts. And then to take that information and then in the context of Detroit, make a recommendation, actually 3 categories of recommendations. So good, better, and best. So good recommendations were based on research and best practices, but they required no additional resources. So in other words, a good recommendation is using exactly what we have, people and materials, what could the district do that would be a good response to this particular issue? And okay. Then better adds additional resources, and then best was, of course, pie in the sky, which hopefully some of those will get funded. But what was really amazing is as the 15 groups presented, the energy in the room was really, you could feel it. It was contagious. And as people get involved in the process, and just to circle back, when I did the all call for people to help, it was right in the middle of the turmoil that we were facing around our funding and around coming off of these sick outs. And what this said to me is that we have an incredibly dedicated staff here in Detroit Public Schools Community District and people who really want us to be better. And that was greatly encouraging to me, and it still is greatly encouraging to me as we move forward to the fall.
I have to follow up on one more detail, though, on the sick outs from this spring. You were a teacher. I'm very curious to know if you were still in the classroom, do you think you would have participated in a walkout?
That's a great question. And, you know, I think it's always interesting when people look back at history and say what they would or wouldn't do when they didn't actually have to make the choice. So I'm going to defer to say I don't know, because I was not in that position. And I think it's in some ways inappropriate to conjecture. I've heard a lot of times, you know, when people talk about injustices in history and they say, well, if I were alive then, I would have done this or that. And the truth of the matter is, until you're in that situation, I don't think you know exactly what you would do. And so I will say that because I was not in a classroom this spring, I can't answer that question truthfully.
Do you want to be the permanent superintendent?
What I want for Detroit Public Schools Community District is consistent leadership that puts students and staff ahead of everything else, and working with the community and making sure that we, a year from now, we're in a better situation than we are now. And if I can play a role in that continuing past January, I would welcome that opportunity.
Well, you're already interim. It would seem if you held on to the position, that would amount to consistent leadership. Will you pursue that?
Well, as you know, the elected board takes office in January, and within 90 days of their taking office, they need to appoint a superintendent. And so when we get to that point, I will have to make a decision about what I will be doing moving forward. But at this point, my main mission is to put things in place right now that are so good that nobody wants to change them, because we're headed on the right path. And I think moving forward, we're looking at September 6th, then we look at the election, then we look forward to local control returning in January.
We want to thank our guest. Alicia Merriweather is the interim superintendent of the Detroit Public Schools. Thank you for joining us. Good luck.
All right. Thank you very much. We will take all the luck that we can get. Thank you.
Okay. Coming up on Current State, Peckham Incorporated is a respected nonprofit in Lansing known for providing job training for people with disabilities. Some of its employees are part of Peckham's self-advocacy team, which allows them to play an active role in advocating for disability rights. We'll learn more about the initiative here in our Neighbors in Action segment coming up. Well, with the Michigan summer travel season in full swing, we take you to Grand Rapids today for a tour of the newly renovated Gerald R. Ford Presidential Museum. It reopened last month after a full redo of much of the 54,000-square-foot facility. Permanent exhibits continue to include a full-scale replica of the Oval Office, interactive cabinet room, a 1976 bicentennial display, and a section of the Berlin Wall. Another exhibit pays tribute to the life and influence of Betty Ford, who's credited with paving the way for modern first ladies. WKAR's Peter Whorf and the Gerald Ford's public affairs specialist Kristen Mooney start our walkthrough in Ford's collegiate days.
Right around here. So we're in his young youth section.
Right.
Again, we start the story at the beginning. And you'll see that the colors are a lot brighter.
Right. The maize and blue is prominent.
Yeah. Maize and blue. But basically, you can see what we've done in the new exhibits. It's a lot brighter. It's a better feel. Mm-hmm. The artifacts are placed, you know, so that you can see quite a few more things. Photographs are highly prevalent. We use a lot of visuals to help walk people through.
I can see where you have a lot of new photographs, and even the older photographs, of course, in black and white, are enhanced and sharp, as well as the text.
Yes, yep. And basically what we wanted to do was find a way to appeal to our historians, our younger visitors, our just average visitors here just dabbling, you know, visiting presidential libraries. We wanted to find a way to wrap them into President Ford's story.
Great photo there of Ford, maybe at a football practice. There he is. I've never seen a candid like that before of Ford. He looks like a man in his early 20s.
He looks like a regular guy, doesn't he?
Just a regular guy taking a break from football practice with a teammate.
He's got his football pants on, a white T-shirt, kind of sweaty. It's great.
This looks like a class photo of some kind.
Yep. And actually what we're looking at right here are his years in Yale. And so he was coaching at the time. And this is probably a picture from when he also assisted in that area.
This is a fantastic photo over here, not just because of the subject of the photo with the football coaches, like you were saying, with Ford at Yale, but the intensity of the photo looking right into the lens.
It does, it is. And there's something about that 1930s, 1940s era of photography that when they got it, it was great. You can feel the emotion.
Fantastic.
Growing up in Grand Rapids, Jerry's close-knit family included three younger brothers. He became an avid Eagle Scout and captain of his high school football team. He went to the University of Michigan, earning a degree in economics and Most Valuable Player honors in football.
And then we continue on into, obviously, World War II. That also shaped his life. And again, this is a more interactive exhibit, so I'll say for radio, you need to be here to see it. You get an actual feel of being on the USS Monterey flight deck and a feel for what Ford went through.
Right. I remember some of these things from last year, but
yeah,
there's a lot of new items and you've rearranged.
Yes, yep. Like the congressional desk here, that obviously was in our old exhibit, but this time you can 360 around it. And even with the Oval Office, for example, we opened up the back windows, so you can actually walk around now and get a bird's eye view of the president's desk. Yep. So some of the things that we've got the same, we've reiterated them so that you can get a better view.
Here's a photo. So many photos, you can't remember them all after one or two visits, but I don't remember seeing this one of the then Betty Bloomer as a fashion model.
Yes, she was a fashion model. She also was a dance instructor as well as a dance troubadour in the Martha Graham dance project in New York. And actually, that is a picture. What we've got here is Betty laying out with her dress all around her. And that was a picture of her at the finale of one of her dance recitals.
Was that one here before?
It was actually very small. Okay. You probably would not have noticed it. We've enlarged it and made it near life size.
But when World War II erupted, Ford joined the U.S. Navy in 1942. He served as a lieutenant of the
I was wondering if we could look at one of the touch screens.
Yeah, let's find one.
Okay, great.
There we go. Just have to touch it quick. So we're looking at the Dig Deeper Betty Ford section here, and it's a touchscreen display. And you can click on related stories and objects, and you can look at actual documents that we have in our collection. So this is a question and answers to the Equal Rights Amendment. This would have been sent out. As you know, Mrs. Ford was a big proponent for the Equal Rights Amendment, spokesperson and everything. So you can see the actual pamphlet here, and you can thumb through it and get a little more detail, which we wouldn't be able to put this whole pamphlet on display, so this is a great way for people who want to do that. Then if you want to look at other things, there's another document here on equal rights, a case for the Equal Rights Amendment. And again, you can look at what's in the collection. This would actually be in the archives in Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. And if you're doing research, you can get in and see these things. But for the average visitor, these things are off limits. Right. So this is a great way for us to give you a little more information on some of those things that Mrs. Ford dealt with.
It kind of leaves room to show some other objects and photographs,
yes,
and artifacts and things like that. And if you want to go a little deeper into the text and the history, then here are your screens.
You're able to do that.
Kristen Mooney at the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Museum in Grand Rapids, taking a look at the relaunch of the museum.
And then one last thing that I will show you that was not in the original exhibit, or our last iteration, obviously with the funeral happening, we are able to actually dedicate a complete room to the president's and Mrs. Ford's funerals. And this is wonderful because it overlooks the gravesite area outside. So this was actually one of the reasons for the renovation, was to pay actual tribute and to do this room right.
Or why they've been thrust upon him. He was just a man of the people from Michigan. He and Betty Ford brought a lot of dignity and decency at a time when we really...
So here we're hearing some of the tributes at his funeral and overlooking the final resting places,
yes, right? Overlooking the grave site. And so it's a wonderful end to the exhibits. It's a great way to finally conclude the story. We were able to include the last chapter.
Kristen Mooney at the Gerald R. Ford Presidential Library in Grand Rapids. Thanks again.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Peter Warren.
And Gerald Ford was sworn in as the 38th President of the United States.
So help me God.
And coming up on Current State, Kate DiCamillo is the author of acclaimed stories for young people, including Because of Winn-Dixie and The Tale of Despero. The New York Times calls Kate DiCamillo's latest book triumphant and necessary. I'll talk with the author about that story, Ramey Nightingale. That and more after the break on Current State. Current State, three times daily, Monday through Friday, here on 90.5 FM. Glad you're along. I'm Mark Bayshore. Lansing's Peckham Incorporated is a nonprofit vocational rehabilitation organization that offers job training opportunities for people with significant disabilities and other barriers to employment. One interesting feature of the operation is Peckham's self-advocacy team, where employees who have disabilities play an active role in advocating for disability rights. Now, for Neighbors in Action today, we're joined by Peckham Vocational Services Specialist Stacy Locke. Stacy, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you.
Also, Scott Cole is president of the self-advocacy team. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
And Sandy Wolf is a team ambassador. Hi, Sandy.
Thank you.
Sure. Stacy, many of our listeners are familiar with Peckham, but mm-hmm. for a newcomer to town, describe what the larger mission of Peckham is.
So we're a nonprofit rehabilitation agency. We have about five different business lines, and people with disabilities work in those various business lines. So, for example, one of them would be the call center. So if a person is calling in to they want to know some information about their passport, people with disabilities will be answering that phone call for them.
Okay. And tell us more. Let's go a little deeper here into the Workforce Action Team. What role does it have?
So the Workforce Action Team that was the previous name. So I started to mentor this group about 3 years ago. I had worked with the Michigan Rehabilitation Association. I was the chair of public policy, and what we would do is we would take rehab counseling students from Wayne State, Michigan State University, and Western University to Washington, D.C., and advocate on behalf of rehabilitation counselors in the profession. So what happened was, about 3 years ago, the team's staff were in transition, and so they were kind of moving out into other areas of the company. I went to my coordinator and I said, I would love to work with this team of people and see if we can teach them self-advocacy so that they can be their own self-advocate.
Right.
I wanted to still advocate for people with disabilities, but I really wanted to
empower
teach people how to do that
yeah,
themselves.
Of
yeah.
Course,
so,
of course.
So we started working together. And then maybe about a year and a half ago, one of the things that we kept noticing with local, state, and federal legislators is, well, what is the Workforce Action Team? And so we wanted to have a name that was more self-explanatory. So it's transitioned to Peckham Self-Advocacy Team now.
Very good. And
yeah.
Scott and Sandy, our other two guests, both of you have done advocacy. Scott, what on the local level, what kind of advocacy have you done?
I personally have not done a whole lot on the local level because I don't live in Lansing. Sandy has done more work locally.
But you've both done state
yes.
and federal. Okay, I got a little confused there. Talk to us about the state and the federal advocacy you've done.
With state, for an example, I've spoken with my representative, Tom Leonard, who chairs the insurance committee, House Insurance Committee. I've spoken with him about protecting auto no fault. And I do believe I have gotten a little bit across to them that, you know, we do need to keep that around. Mm-hmm. Maybe some changes, but it does need to stay in place.
Have you been to Washington then?
I have.
Okay. What discussions did you have there?
There it was more advocating on behalf of Source America for employment opportunities for people with disabilities.
Okay. Sandy, what about the local advocacy then? You've been involved in that.
I have been very involved with the local. I go to a lot of the city council meetings,
mm-hmm.
which are, I think, once a month, I think. And then I also go to the ad hoc committees, which is every other Friday, which is we work on diversity and
inclusion.
For people that have disabilities, and we have been appointed right on the committee. The Peckham has been.
You've got a place on that that committee.
Yes,
you've also been active on the federal level here. What have you done?
Federal. I just got back from Washington, also 2 weeks ago already, and there we We also talk with Source America. That's what the Washington trip is.
Source America.
Yes.
Okay.
And there we spoke with four senators and four representatives, and I told them my story and why it's important for us to be able to work and not to take these workplaces away from us.
Right. Understood. We're learning about Peckham's self-advocacy team here today on Current State's Neighbors in Action. You just heard from Sandy Wolf, a team ambassador. We're also joined by Scott Cole, president of the self-advocacy team, and vocational services specialist Stacy Locke. Describe your role exactly in this effort, Stacy.
So the self-advocates, they always have their own main area of advocacy. And that might be because of their disability. It might be because of things that they need to have in order to have better treatment or maintain employment. So I kind of connect them to different areas within the local, state, and federal level that will help them do that advocacy. So part of initially when we were advocating with the city council, I was taking them to the city council meetings, kind of teaching them also how to advocate. So mm-hmm. talking about the strengths and the weaknesses of policy and how it affects them as a person
yeah.
with a disability, and then giving those solutions and suggestions and ideas. And I really believe it's because of the way we have a very diplomatic approach. So we try to befriend everyone. You know, sometimes when you're in politics, you're either Republican or, you know, a Democrat, and people don't get along. But what we teach is we get along with everyone because everyone has influence in policy. And so because of those that that initial advocacy work at the local level, I think that that's why they appointed us to the ad hoc committee and on diversity and inclusion.
Scott, do you feel like these conversations, do you feel like you get somewhere with these conversations?
I really do.
It's awareness raising.
Yeah,
it is. Yeah, yeah.
And we also, part of our approach too is education. So we're not lobbyists. We don't get paid to lobby, but we do provide education. And so what we're learning is that I think that we also had this myth that there are going to be some parties that support us and some parties that don't. But what we're learning now is that all of the parties support us and they want everyone to be working. And so that's been, I think, very a very neat thing to learn as we began this self-advocacy journey. But the other thing, too, with Washington, D.C., the other thing is we have 164 members of Congress who are an Ability One champion. So you have Ability One contracts. Source America has those contracts, and Source America works with all these community rehab agencies like
right.
Peckham across the nation to connect them to those contracts. And in those contracts, they're required to have so many people with disabilities working within those contracts. And so, you know, Representative Wahlberg, when Scott and I were there last year, he ended up becoming an Ability One champion.
Mm-hmm.
And right now we're partnering with Representative Mike Bishop. And he is very supportive of our business model and, you know, keeping people with disabilities working. And so we're on the third step. There's four steps to become an Ability One champion. So he's on that third step. So hopefully within the next few months, he will be another Ability One champion.
So congressman by congressman, you're raising the awareness of the role that Peckham plays and all of these other rehab organizations
yes.
play.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never forget my first visit to Peckham, the first real visit to Peckham, probably 5 years or so ago. I did a story on what was going on out there and walked into the floor and saw dozens and dozens and dozens of people mm-hmm. in this enormous space working on sewing machines
mm-hmm.
because, I don't know if you still have the contract
yes.
or not, but you still have the contract to assemble military apparel of some
mm-hmm.
of some
mm-hmm.
sort.
Mm-hmm.
So it's those federal contracts, and part of the deal of getting the federal contract is making sure that a certain number of disabled people are
mm-hmm.
are at those machines,
mm-hmm.
right?
And I think the important piece to that, because there's some disability advocates that don't really believe that that should be happening, that we should, you know, do some things a little bit differently. But here's the key. People with disabilities want to support our country. They want to give something back to America.
Mm.
But they necessarily can't be in the military, whether it's because of a physical disability or a mental health disability. They don't meet the qualifications to join. But when they're making that clothing for that soldier, they are so proud
yeah.
of what they are doing and that they are clothing our soldiers that are going to war.
Sandy and Scott, you've both endured brain trauma, I'm told. Scott, describe what it's like to live with your brain trauma.
There is really no good way to describe it. You have to really experience it, which is never a good thing, of course. I don't wish that on anybody.
Mm.
Personally, my symptoms are primarily emotional. I really tend towards anger, but I have developed methods now to help control that so I can still be a member of society and
mm-hmm.
participate.
Sandy, what about you?
Every day is a new challenge. I think that's the best way to explain it, because when you wake up in the morning, you don't know if you're going to be bouncing off walls because you can't walk straight, or you could be walking straight and just having a crazy day.
Mm.
It's, every day is different.
Mm.
And I kind of like that, because at least it's not a 9-to-5 job.
Well, tell us how people can get involved, and do you involve volunteers in your effort?
Absolutely. So anyone that is employed at Peckham can get involved. What we typically do is have them attend a couple of meetings, because we are very advocacy. We have one focus area. And so we want them to come in and kind of check that out. Some people are familiar with advocacy and some people are not. They don't
mm-hmm.
really know what that looks like. So they'll attend a couple of meetings and then they'll determine on whether or not they want to actually join. We have a little process of doing an interview to see what kind of advocacy work they may have done in the past and how they would fit into the group and what advocacy areas that they want to participate in.
Well, we have really enjoyed learning more about this effort. This is Peckham Industries self-advocacy team here in Lansing. We want to thank Sandy Wolf, team ambassador, Stacy Locke, and Scott Cole, president of the self-advocacy team. Stay in touch. We want to know what's going on at Peckham. We appreciate your being here today.
Thank you so much.
Will do. Thank you for having us.
And Current State is looking for more nominations for our weekly Neighbors in Action feature. Email us your suggestions, please, to currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line. Author Kate DiCamillo has been writing best-selling books and stories for younger readers since 2000. She also counts adult readers as fans. The author's written two Newbery Medal winners, The Tale of Despereaux and Flora and Ulysses, along with the Newbery Honor winner, Because of Winn-Dixie. She's also the author of the successful Mercy Watson series about an extraordinary pet pig. Ahead of a visit to the Wharton Center here in East Lansing this Saturday, I spoke with Kate DiCamillo by phone yesterday. I began by asking her about the 10-year-old girl at the center of her latest story, Rainey Nightingale.
So Rainey Clark is 10 years old, and we're in Central Florida in the mid-70s, and Rainey's father has left the family. And Rainey has this plan that what she's going to do is enter the Little Miss Central Florida tire contest, win the contest, get her picture in the paper, and then her father will see her picture in the paper, and then he'll come home. Mm. So that's how Rainey thinks that she's going to solve this problem of her father leaving. And things do not at all go as she plans.
And I want to make sure our listeners heard this was the Little Miss
Central Florida Tire Contest.
Tire contest.
Now, wouldn't you want to enter that contest?
I would, and I would want to win it. you told NPR that Rainey is, quote, very much like the child that I was, very introverted, watching, worrying, wondering, but also hopeful.
Boy, that is true. That's the kid I was, and that kid is still right here inside of me. That, you know, and this is as close as I've ever come to putting myself in a book. This is exactly the kind of kid that I was.
And were you making an effort to bring your family together as well?
No, but I did think that it was my fault. Because I think that's what kids think. And I was at a loss as to what to do. But I did feel like if I had been a different kind of kid, it wouldn't have happened to begin with. Mm. If I'd been a better kid.
The New York Times' Amber Dermont called it not only captivating and triumphant, but necessary as well. That is high praise when your work is called necessary. How did you interpret that comment?
Well, when you just said that again, that review knocked me off my feet. And when you read that just now, it made me tear up. I don't know. It makes me think that, how, important it is for people to tell their stories, you know, and how there are so many, there's been a big emotional response to this book from kids and from adults. And so I just feel so grateful to be getting to do this and then to connect to people in that way.
We're talking with author Kate DiCamillo. Her latest is called Rainey Nightingale. She is also this year's National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, selected by the U.S. Library of Congress. Kate DiCamillo speaks at East Lansing's Wharton Center this Saturday afternoon in an event presented by the Capital Area District Library and co-sponsored by WKAR. It's easy enough to assume that you see the world through a young person's eyes. Is it fair to say you do?
It is. And I remember with the very first book and one of the very first interviews that I did, and somebody, because the first book is from a 10-year-old's perspective, and the interviewer said, "And now how do you get into the mind of a 10-year-old? And I just was so gobsmacked by the question, because to me it was so, it's like that I was a 10-year-old. I think, you know, Beverly Cleary had all of her 100th birthday celebration stuff, and they ran a couple of interviews with her on NPR, and in one of them she said, that part of me is just very close to the surface. I never have to work to access it. And that's the way it is for me. It's just always there.
On your website, you also say how important paying attention is if you're writing stories. Is paying attention work, or does paying attention come easily to you?
I learned to pay attention through writing. And I learned it's actually like imagining your way into other people's lives. And as a shy person, I've also learned to ask people questions all the time. And that curiosity, that question asking has turned into genuine curiosity about people. I have to stop myself from staring at people. And I tell the kids, get on some mode of public transportation, pay attention to people, start writing things down in the notebook. You'll find enough for a whole novel and one bus ride.
So in the end, did you become a writer because you had to tell stories? You really couldn't control that in a way?
You are asking me good questions. I think I want to answer this very carefully. I think that because I'm a reader, there gets to be a point where you want to tell a story back. But I think that telling a story is how I make sense out of the world. And I think that I am one of those lucky people who has found exactly what they're supposed to do, and I get to do it.
We're talking with author Kate DiCamillo. She is coming to East Lansing at the Paysant Theater at Wharton Center this Saturday afternoon in an event presented by the Capital Area District Library and co-sponsored by WKAR. Will you always only write seriously for children and young people, or is there something Iris Murdochian waiting to burst out of you?
I have to say, let's just have a pause for a minute and say this is the first time that Iris Murdochian has been said today, at least, and maybe even this week. When I write, there is no difference in sentence structure or vocabulary or anything like that for writing for kids and writing for adults for me. But there is always this thing that Katherine Patterson, who is such a wonderful writer for kids, said, when you write for kids, you're duty-bound to end with hope. And that dictum is always kind of at the back of my head, and I like what it does to me as a writer, and I like what it does to me as a person. So I feel like I will stay here and not join Iris Murdoch.
We've been talking with author Kate DiCamillo. Her latest is called Ramey Nightingale. She's also this year's National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, selected by the Library of Congress. And Kate DiCamillo speaks at East Lansing's Wharton Center this Saturday afternoon. Nice talking with you, Kate DiCamillo. Continued success.
Oh, thank you so much. It was a great deal of fun.
And that's our show for today here on Current State. Coming up on tomorrow's program, drones have evolved from reconnaissance to recreation to retail. The FAA has recently published new standards for hobbyists and commercial drone operators. Those will supersede countless local ordinances established across the country, including cities like East Lansing and DeWitt. Current State's Kevin Lavery talks with Ryan LaTourette, founder of the Grand Ledge business venture Capital Drones. Plus, the Wharton Center brings some Broadway professionals to teach kids from across Michigan this summer. We'll learn more about the week-long program called Take It From the Top from the Wharton Center's education director, a Broadway leading actress herself, Chris Ouellette. That and more tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of the program is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. Don't forget the Current State podcast, informative, insightful, indispensable, and oh so convenient. It covers everything that we do on our program. Catch it anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get quality podcasts. Also, stay connected with us on social media. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. Find us on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Have a great day. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR.